The following program is a co-production of NJN Public Radio and the New Jersey Historical Commission. Funding for the program was provided by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, a state partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Historical Commission. The views expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect those of the Council, the Commission, or New Jersey Network.
At the place where the meeting was going to be forbidden, the people from New York got out of the shiny sedans of various makes. The sheriff was a fat man with a badge like a star off a Christmas tree. The cops were waving their clubs about, limbering up their arms. "All right, move 'em along," said the sheriff. The people who had come from New York climbed back into the shiny sedans of various makes and drove away. The procession went back the way it had come, down empty streets, past endless facades of deserted mills, past brick tenements with ill-painted stoops, past groups of squat square women with yellow-gray faces, groups of men and boys standing still, saying nothing, looking nowhere, square hands hanging at their sides, people square and still, chunks of yellow-gray stone at the edge of a quarry, idle, waiting, on strike. John Dos Passos.
Every morning, every evening, they got fun. Not much money, oh, but money, we got fun.
Well, the 1920s is presented as a time of sort of gaiety and short skirts and short hair and lots of women dancing around. Like people were supposed to have had money and fun. But the reality of the 20s is that it was a very huge gap between the rich and the poor.
The rich get rich and the poor get children. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
The 1920s roared all right with the siren of injustice, the Red Scare, lynchings, and the labor wars. Nowhere was this battle between the haves and have-nots more brutal than in Passaic, New Jersey, 15 miles west of Manhattan. Here, in 1926, 16,000 wool workers walked out after their meager wages had been cut 10%. It was a long strike, nearly a year, and it caught the attention of intellectuals and activists nationwide. Over the harsh winter of 1926, Passaic became a battleground, not just between workers and bosses, but between the traditional trade unions and a renegade organizer in the American Communist Party, who envisioned a militant industrial union for all workers. Now the story of Passaic on strike.
I was born in Passaic. I lived either in Passaic or in Clifton most of my life.
The late James Shenton was a legendary historian and teacher at Columbia University. He once recalled that immigrant culture was so strong in Passaic, New Jersey, it was like living in Eastern Europe.
My grandmother, who came in 1878 and died in 1931, never learned to speak English. She didn't have to. She could speak Hungarian because that was part of the fact of being born in Hungary. Slovak. If you know Slovak, you more or less know Czech. You knew Polish. She picked up German. By the time she got here, she knew enough languages that English was sort of an impediment. In a way, it becomes a world in which the Starababa, the old women, the old grandmas, wearing the babushkas, was part of the normal life of this town. My mother's family came from the area of Slovakia, which is called the Spiš area. This was an area which had apparently some kind of an influx of Germans, and it was an area of what was then the Kingdom of Hungary, in which wool production was an aspect of their daily lives.
In Passaic, daily life was dominated by two woolen mills, the Botany and the Forstmann and Huffmann, both German-owned. In 1890, Congress had passed a tariff that made it prohibitively expensive to import wool, so the Germans opened mills here.
When World War I began, the Alien Custodian Commission seized control of the factories that were German-owned.
Again, James Shenton.
And who exactly was put in charge? American officers. When World War I ended, Colonel Charles Johnson, who'd been in charge of the Botany Woolen Mills, effectively began fighting to gain control. The Germans began to fight for regaining control, and this began to reflect itself in work conditions. The working class got caught in between in these fights. Wages began to come down. This is where it gets really uneasy. The Bolshevik element came in, and the CP became a fact of life in this area.
In the wake of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the fledgling Communist Party in America, the CP, offered an alternate vision for the working class in Passaic. To the unassimilated immigrants, communism was not a frightening foreign ideology, rather a way to gain control of their lives. The Red Scare didn't scare them.
There was a tremendous wave of government-inspired but also conservative propaganda.
Paul Buell, senior lecturer in American civilization at Brown University.
Under which the Russian Revolution, for instance, was described as having nationalized women. The atheistic quality of the new Russian leadership was played up as an attack on God, through which all respectable, God-fearing, and monogamous Americans were told that they had to resist communism because otherwise there would be godless triumph and no sexual morality.
Many youthful idealists whose sympathies lay with low-paid workers didn't buy the Red Scare either. Some joined the Young Communist League.
Ah, yes. It had a following among young people in their teens and in their early 20s, mostly in Manhattan and Brooklyn, the Bronx, and so on, that was absolutely idealistic and willing and eager to do anything, to travel anywhere, to take any personal risk, and very frequently these were young women.
For me, the historic Passaic strike began one evening in December 1925 as I was westward bound from New York on a train of the Erie Railroad.
Vera Bush, a young activist living in Caldwell, New Jersey, was drawn to the cause. There are no known recordings of her story. She died in 1987, but she wrote a memoir.
This time I was not headed for Caldwell, but for Passaic, one of the many small industrial towns of northern New Jersey. As we jogged over the Jersey Meadows, a vast, barren, swampy tract, little inhabited and bisected by the Hackensack River, all of it now smothered in evening mist, I was feeling a certain trepidation.
Bush had been recruited by Bert Miller, a Communist Party organizer in New York City. She was on her way to see a young Harvard Law graduate named Albert Weisbord, who was organizing the woolen workers in Passaic.
Weisbord met me at the station. As we walked down Main Avenue, with just a quick appraising glance at me, he plunged at once into an exposition of what seemed to be his dominating interest. He talked fast, a sort of machine gun fire. Though he appeared tired, as if from lack of sleep, he was nonetheless vigorous, and his concentration was intense. In the little office, some working men were playing checkers in one corner, while in another a slim, dark-eyed youth softly drew a tune out of a harmonica.
The harmonica player was Mike Alasic, a local strike leader from Passaic who showed Vera around a town that was about to become part of labor history.
Mike Alasic and I crossed the railroad tracks, at once entering the mill section of town. The dingy two- or three-storied frame buildings were dark, and complete silence prevailed as though everyone were already asleep. Soon we came to a bridge over a river. Here a raw wind swept down the valley. I shivered in my winter coat. The city behind us cast a faint glow over the sky. The water shimmered vaguely. Here the mills were all around us, near and far, up and down the river. Forstmann Huffman, big rich company, said Mike, pointing to a huge structure not far away, lighted by floodlights on the lawn in front. They have other big mills in Garfield, pointing in another direction. Here is Botany Worsted Mill. I work here. Father, mother also. Mother works on night shift. It appeared to be a big complex of buildings of different sizes, some lighted, some dark. In one immense building, windows were all alight. The whole structure throbbed with life. Looms crashed and wheels whirred, all blending in an incessant pounding rhythm, like some giant heart permeating the winter night.
Mill worker Michael Asik showed Vera Bush the industrial landscape. Organizer Albert Weisbord put her to work, asked her whether she'd be willing to teach an English class for the workers. She agreed to come back to Passaic the following week and to have supper with Weisbord.
Now I found myself opposite organizer Weisbord at a little table in a Chinese restaurant. There was a suggestion of suppressed passion in his heavy eyelids and in the softness of his voice. We talked chiefly of our backgrounds. What I said had to be in words pushed in edgewise whenever there might be a pause in his almost unceasing flow of speech. I told him of my home life, my Puritan background, my long struggle with tuberculosis. When he heard I had joined the Communist Party among the first, had been briefly in the underground and also in the IWW, I could see a hint of respect from him.
Albert Weisbord, who would come to lead the Passaic wool workers' strike, was born in New York City, December 9, 1900, of Russian Jewish parents. At City College, he joined the Brooklyn branch of the Socialist Party. By 1920, he'd become an organizer, attending street corner rallies and distributing literature. All along, he continued to work in his father's garment factory, which had no union.
During the times I was working packing shoulder pads for delivery, I would make some effort to urge the workers to organize and to improve their poor conditions. When word of this reached my father, he grew very angry, accusing me of being ungrateful and disloyal. But I told him it was a matter of principle with me. I left home not to see the family again for 12 years.
Weisbord put himself through Harvard Law School, not so much to practice law, he later wrote, as to study how laws result from social forces. Meanwhile, he was rising in the Young People's Socialist League, elected secretary. He found himself in the leadership of the Socialist Party. But when he failed to convince the SP to organize militant unions, he quit.
I had become convinced that my place was with the actual working class, not with the SP. I gave up my old associates and joined the Communist Workers' Party in Boston. I was concerned with testing myself whether I had really broken from my petty bourgeois past and was fit to call myself a communist. The only way I could test myself was to immerse myself in the working class, to get a job in a factory. Here I would find myself.
First, Weisbord worked at a silk mill in New England, then moved to New Jersey to become a weaver in Paterson. When the silk workers in West New York, New Jersey, went on strike, Weisbord was there. But that strike was small and short-lived compared to the one that loomed on the horizon. On September 25, 1925, the management of the huge Botany wool mills in nearby Passaic announced a 10% wage cut. Other mills followed suit. In October, 350 workers walked out of the Passaic Worsted and Spinning Company. Albert Weisbord left West New York and headed for Passaic.
The first thing was to get some contacts and learn the true situation firsthand. The party did have a Hungarian workers' club in Passaic, part of the Hungarian Federation. Here I met Gus Diak, who, as a young mill worker, represented exactly the kind I wanted to take leadership. The Hungarian workers readily agreed to arrange a mass meeting for me and help distribute flyers. They were able to get Neubauer's Hall for a meeting which I addressed. Hundreds came to sign up for the union.
Weisbord's United Front Committee was becoming a union. He asked for party help in organizing the mass meeting. But official Communist Party policy, going back to Lenin, was to bore from within, to radicalize existing unions, not to create competing ones, no dual unionism. Nonetheless, his ally in New York, Bert Miller, agreed to help.
Now I went back to New York to get a prominent speaker for the big mass meeting to follow. We agreed on Benjamin Gitlow, a good plain speaker who had just come out of Dannemora State Prison on appeal and who was available. The mass meeting in Passaic was a rousing success, but it was about the last time we were to see Gitlow in Passaic. Nor did we ever see Foster or Cannon or Lovestone or any of the bigs in Passaic. Some of them were in Moscow, others wanted to wait and see before participating. Miller, however, did furnish the money for the membership cards and for opening up a headquarters on Main Street.
Under Weisbord's leadership, the strike committee grew. So did tensions inside the largest mill, the Botany, which was still operating. When a worker was fired for being a member of the union, a committee of three went to the mill's manager, Colonel Charles F. H. Johnson, to demand that the worker get his job back. Johnson refused and declared all members of the union would be fired.
On Monday, January 25th, a committee not of three, but of 45, went to see Johnson, and not to beg for reinstatement, but to present their demands. The whole scene was carefully prepared in advance, as were the demands. At a given time, all delegates stopped their machines and went from room to room in a very impressive manner, gathering themselves together into a committee to go to see the management. All the workers quit work to see what would happen. The air was tense. Each moment was an hour. The committee presented their demands and found the management ruthless. All were fired and told to leave by the front gate. Chief of Police Zober and many policemen were there to see that the workers got out quickly. But the committee had rehearsed and was prepared for the whole event. With a burst of force, they flung the police aside. Into every room they scattered with cries of "Strike! Strike!"
Now the strike was truly gaining momentum. According to Vera Bush, it was Weisbord's passionate leadership and the growing sense of solidarity.
One by one, the mills were brought out by picket lines of the workers already on strike. On Wednesday, January 27th, the Garfield Worsted Mill. On January 30th, the Passaic Worsted Spinning Mill. And the next week, on February 6th, the Big Guerra Mill, followed by the New Jersey Spinning Company. Now, with a permit obtained from a surprised chief of police, a great parade of all these strikers marched past an amazed city population.
Next, the Passaic woolen workers decided to take on the powerful Forstmann Huffman Company, which owned three mills.
The workers in FH had not yet received wage cuts. They were on the hunger treatment. That is, they were working part-time, a situation which, as they learned by experience, often preceded wage cuts. With their spirits broken, the workers would not resist the cuts when they came. Forstmann Huffman had a company union called the Assembly, the chief purpose of which was to keep the workers obedient to the company. This did not prevent a good number of people from the largest FH mill, which employed 4,000, from joining the United Front Committee.
The frantic bosses were determined to stop the ever-onward march of the workers. On Monday, police mounted on horse and motorcycles appeared. Terror Week had started.
To reach the biggest of the FH mills, located in nearby Garfield, it was necessary to cross the Ackerman Avenue Bridge over the Passaic River. Having been briefed to expect trouble, the workers braced themselves. The strongest forces had been mobilized. The entire strike committee headed the march. Newspapers from the whole metropolitan area had been notified so that reporters and cameramen were ready at the bridge.
The crowd grew to 3,000. On the Clifton side of the Passaic River, the police headed off the strikers before they could cross the bridge and reach the Forstmann-Huffman Mill. Suddenly, four motorcycle policemen roared up. Some boys pelted them with snowballs, and women shouted insults. The police drew their clubs and charged into the crowd. Demonstrators attempted to flee the screaming clubs. Clifton Captain of Detectives Anthony Botello ordered his men to prevent the newspaper photographers from taking pictures of the melee. Again, Vera Bush.
Many of the casualties came into the office that day with bleeding head wounds, or limping, or holding an arm or shoulder bruised by the clubs. At the mass meeting that evening, one of the most severely beaten strikers was up on the platform. When he took off his shirt to expose his broad upper back, completely covered with black and blue marks, a shudder and a groan went through the ranks. Some wept. The town, the New York area, and the entire country were horrified when the pictures were released showing the police wielding their clubs on defenseless strikers.
In the national spotlight, the strikers now hired Mary Heaton Vorse, the foremost labor journalist of the day, to tell their side of the story. She began publishing a strike newspaper, historian D. Garrison of Rutgers University.
It was called the Textile Workers Bulletin, and it was published every week, sometimes even more often. And it is so important historically because it represents an entirely new kind of union tactic in appealing not writing just to the workers, not to the talking among strike leaders, but an appeal to the wider public. It was supposed to appeal to radical ministers, everyone, you know, and it did. It was also given worldwide, international kind of attention. And that, it was beautifully written, of course. She's a fabulous writer.
In the March 31st, 1926 edition of the Textile Strike Bulletin, Mary Heaton Vorse wrote a portrait of one of the strikers. It was titled, Mrs. Bresnack and the Picket Line.
She never misses picket lines. You always see her tramping sturdily along, a short, powerful figure, broad-shouldered, deep-breasted, a heavy-built woman, strong. Her mouth is a determined line. Her nose juts out obstinately. Her eyes are two bright, sparkling points. Humor and intelligence are in them, and often indignation and anger. She never misses a meeting. After the meeting, you could see her in the hall talking. Maybe she's telling about what happened on the picket line. Maybe she's telling how her husband first made 15 cents an hour, and pretty soon that is all the workers will be getting if they don't win the strike. Round and round, she's always at strike meetings at night. She is a delegate of the United Front Committee from the Botany Mills. In some way, she embodies the spirit of the strike more than any one person. Strong, powerful, persistent, and is fortified with the indignation of years. That is Mrs. Anna Bresnack. She is not an individual. She embodies the working mothers whose slow anger is now kindled.
Well, she brought the strike alive. She brought the people alive.
Again, Professor D. Garrison.
And remember, she also had all those ties to the Greenwich Village groups. She was able to bring into Passaic, literally, physically, many of these New York intelligentsia and artists and writers. She loved to take some rich or upper class or middle class intellectual into a home in Passaic, the workers' homes, where there were no windows, where it was literally dark constantly, where 16 people often lived in one room in the family. And when you see that, you don't forget it.
As the striking wool workers struggled through the cold winter of 1926, many began to run short of food and fuel. But the publicity triggered a flow of money and relief supplies through the Communist Party's Workers International Relief Organization. Albert Weisbord later reflected, with some ambivalence, that the party must have raised $1 million.
Over half of this was siphoned off for party use. So long as these funds were used, if only in part, to pay all the union's bills, I really had no objection that the party was the major beneficiary. since it and it alone could have mounted the campaign, could use the money for the organization of the unorganized in other places. But of course, this was not the intention of the party leadership at all. What they found was a bonanza for them that could help them mightily in their factional struggles.
If half the relief was diverted, the other half got to the hungry strikers.
Well, the food was brought in from out of town.
At age 16, Martha Stone Asher was one of a handful of idealistic young New Yorkers who came to help the striking Passaic wool workers. She is now 95 years old and lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Bakers donated food, and other places, larger places, produced food, made donations, and that was just tremendous. And in fact, at one time, the strikers who were handling a big truck filled with food were stopped by the police, and they arrested him, and they arrested all the bread. So getting the bread out, the men who were driving the truck, I don't have their names, were released. After bond was put up for them and they were released. But the question of getting the bread out was a big problem, and it became a big issue among the strikers until the bread was freed. That's how they talked about it. And they were able to then distribute it to the... There were about 7 stations, as I recall. I might not be right about the number.
Now a change took place in my own status in the strike.
Again, Vera Bush, Weisbord's protege, who taught English to the workers.
One day I went to visit the soup kitchen for the strikers' children, run by the Council of Working Class Housewives, a group of Jewish women, residents of Passaic, most of them members of the Workers' Party. They were giving hours of their time daily, canvassing stores to get donations of food and preparing a hearty soup or stew, which with bread and milk provided one good meal a day for the strikers' children. It occurred to me this work should be done by the women strikers. I reported the idea to Albert, who concurred and made arrangements for me to contact the women at the picket station. Although my little speech was amateurish enough, the women responded at once, a good number coming out to a meeting to get the work organized. It looked as though the women had only been waiting for a chance to apply their creative energies. I trained the women to run their own meetings. I insisted that each one had to take her turn at being chairwoman. Many would hesitate, object. These work-worn women, mothers of families, would even cry. I insisted, if you can't speak English, do it in Polish or Italian or whatever.
The women marched shoulder to shoulder with the men on the picket line and were in the heart of all activities of the union. The strike freed the women, the worst enslaved of all. They were made to feel the breath of life that a union puts into their beings. Special clubs were formed, attached to the national organization of the United Council of Working Class Women. Not only the women strikers, but the wives of the men were drawn into the struggle through these women's clubs. It was the women who managed the children's kitchens and did the 1,001 strike duties necessary to be performed. These backward peasants, as the labor traders would say, became the greatest strike enthusiasts of all.
Yes.
Again, Martha Stone Asher.
There was one woman who walked through a crowd when the police were trying to hold her up. And she walked with her child, bypassed the police, and came to the head of the line. And every striker had their heart in their mouths. They were afraid that they would just shoot at her. But it never happened. And she walked successfully through the crowd of pickets and placed herself at the head of the line, pushing her carriage with the baby in it.